The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and today, it's been a long time coming, but he's here at last. The star of Stand By Me, Star Trek The Next Generation, The Big Bang Theory, and one of the coolest, craziest internet sensations, a pop culture hero, an icon, Will Wheaton is here. That's right. You might know Will also from Tabletop on YouTube, if you love board games. Yeah, that's his crazy show. He and his celebrity friends get together and play all kinds of board games. He's also a big Dungeons & Dragons guy like me. He's also into video games, especially old school Nintendo and Atari. We got great conversations about all that, great stories. And of course, we talk about Stand By Me, his relationship with the late, great River Phoenix, how Rob Reiner took care of him when he was just a kid, and his great stories of being on the wild and wacky Big Bang Theory, also being a successful child actor and managing to reinvent himself as an adult. All of that is included here. Will is a great guy. He had me to his house. We went into his game area. And I'll tell you what, he's got this garage in the back and all of these board games, probably, I don't know, thousands of board games. He's a gamer, but not a video gamer. He is a board gamer.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, so I'm here like in the board game paradise of Will Wheaton's place here. And this is funny because I love going to people's houses and seeing stuff like this.
Yeah.
For example, Gene Simmons' house is all Kiss everywhere.
Yeah.
Eli Roth has all the movies everywhere here.
Yeah.
It's just, there's probably, I don't know, 1,000 board games in here.
And this isn't my entire board game library. I actually, a friend of mine owns a gaming cafe.
Mm-hmm.
So I store probably 60% of my games in her library, because like I'm not going to play them, right? And I would rather games get played than just like sit on the shelf and look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So my games all live at Donna's cafe, and then everybody can go and play them. And then if I'm like, oh man, I really wish that I had whatever game, I'll just go borrow it back from the library and then take it back
in storage there. Why so many games? What's the deal?
Well, I've always been a board gamer. I've been playing, so I turn 44 next month. I have been like a serious nerd board game player since I was like, I first played D&D when I was 10.
Yeah.
And I have my original D&D.
You do?
I have my original AD&D books right over there on the shelf. I've got my red basic box set that I learned with has long been lost, but I bought one. I bought an unopened copy of it off of eBay, and it was only like $40.
Oh,
so I have another one of those, you know, with the like color them in dice and
what
all
was
that
it,
stuff.
What was it called? Like the company that made it? I know it was Gary Gygax.
TSR.
That was it.
Was that, yeah. And then I have a couple other TSR games that I really like. There was one called Vampire, which is very much like that Fury of Dracula game I was telling you about before we started recording. And then another game called They've Invaded Pleasantville, which is another one that
the
I really like.
Alien Invasion game.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the was there a spy one too? Do you recall? I used to play espionage or something like that, or was it?
Yeah, you know what? There have been, so there was like, there was one called Stop Thief. There was one called Scotland Yard. Gosh, what else? There have been a lot of games like that.
There was one very similar.
I feel like there was a game called Espionage, but I can't remember.
Because I played when I was 10. I'm 44 right now, so we're pretty much the same age.
Yeah.
And Dungeons & Dragons, for me, was like
there was maybe Atari video games or something like this, but yeah. Dungeons and Dragons was all you did for a good 2 years or so.
Yeah.
Every day, play. Yeah. Was it the same for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I grew up on the eastern edge of the San Fernando Valley in California, and my great aunt, who was kind of like my closest relative, and my grandmother died when I was really young, so she was kind of like a grandmother figure to us, and she lives over in the western valley, so my parents would take us over there all the time. I spent a lot of time in the car when I was a kid, and then I was going to auditions all the time when I was a kid.
Right.
So I took D&D books with me because I could read them in the car. I could write up characters in the car. I used to just make characters for fun. Mm-hmm. I would design dungeons on graph paper that I was never going to get a chance to play with, but I just built them all, and I had like just so many books just full of stuff like that. And then Choose Your Own Adventure books.
Great books.
I read those like crazy. And then did you ever read the Lone Wolf books? Do you remember those?
No.
These were super cool. So these it was like Choose Your Own Adventure plus D&D in a book.
Okay.
So when you'd like make a decision, you know, like if you do this, go to whatever page, and then it would say something like, and now you have to fight five skeletons, and you would roll dice, and you had a little character sheet in the front of the book, and you would have to do that. And like, I loved Atari. I was crazy about Nintendo. I think if not for like NHL 94 on Sega Genesis, the original Nintendo would be my favorite gaming system of all time.
I think you're right, because it's funny too, because it was almost like there was a division. Either you were an Atari guy or an Intellivision guy. Like Beatles and Stones.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
And I was so intimidated by that weird Intellivision controller.
Like it was
that
like a disc.
Weird disc thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So I actually bought a like they called it the Intellivision Flashback. So it looks like it television console, and it's basically just an emulator, and it's really cool. It is still as inscrutable to me now as it was when I was a little boy to play with it.
As far as intimidation wise?
Yeah, it's just weird. The controller is like, it's shaped like a remote control.
Yes.
And I mean, I guess if you came to that first, like if we think back to that being like, let's say like 1980, 1981 or something like that, I think whichever controller you came to first was the one that became the way controllers were supposed to be, because the ColecoVision controller was just like the Intellivision controller but with a joystick instead. And the idea of having a multifunction keypad was super advanced for the time, but there was something about Atari being one stick, one button, and that's it.
Yeah.
Right?
But even so much so that when you got used to the Atari joystick, I remember there was even a little thing you could buy that you would stick on that disc. You could actually have your own joystick on the Intellivision controller.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. And there was also Intellivision, I recall, being way more expensive than Atari, because like we could afford Atari, but we couldn't afford Intellivision.
Yes.
And it was like the rich kids on the block had Intellivision.
True, yeah.
So I associated Intellivision like with rich jerks. Do you know what I mean? I mean, just sort of like, and I was like I had GoBots and they had Transformers.
Right. Yeah.
and I just like, I had Shogun Warriors and they had Voltron, right? And like now Shogun Warriors are way cooler than Voltron. But when you're nine and 10, you're like, this is the worst.
Right.
So even though I loved those video games, D&D like lived in my imagination, and it wasn't limited by cartridge memory, and I didn't have to be at a TV to play it. And if my mom was like, go outside, I'm like, okay, and I'd take my D&D books outside with me. So that started it, and all of these games that are in this room can be traced back to that, like starting D&D, and then when I was a freshman in high school, my friends introducing me to Car Wars and the old Warhammer 40,000, Blood Bowl, and stuff like that.
But there's something to be said about that too. I mean, not sounding like, you know, back in my day, but obviously now kids play Call of Duty with their friends. My son does it all the time. It's great to watch.
Yeah.
But for us, pre kind of group gaming, it was board games.
Yeah.
And you would get together with your friends. I remember on my block, it was the Swanston kids, and one was always the Dungeon Master, and you would just go play for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure in the 50s, people would listen to radio plays, and that was the cool thing. But for us, if you grew up in the early 80s, that was the way to socialize.
I gave a talk at Penny Arcade Expo in 2007. I did their keynote address, and I talked about, and at that time, and it's so weird to me that it's almost 10 years ago that I did that, but I was talking about how, like, when I was a kid, if we were going to play multiplayer games, we were this close to each other. Right.
Right? Across
like
the table.
We were sitting on the couch or we were standing in the arcade or whatever. And if anyone ever mouthed off the way people mouth off in multiplayer video games, they would get their ass kicked. and that's at best, or at worst, nobody would play with them.
Right.
Right? Because, like, who wants that kid in the house? Like, you know, F that guy, right?
Yeah.
So in my talk, I said, like, so just, like, I want you to remember, everyone who plays games, that, like, there is value in the community that we build. There's value in having a person to play with. Mm-hmm. You can form friendships. It doesn't have to be about, like, that f***ed your mom. Like, it doesn't have to be that, you know? And that's when I said, so, like, when you're playing games, just don't be a dick. Mm-hmm. You know, if you win, like, talk trash. That's fun, right? Like, I love the trash talk. But there's a point where it has to go, all right, but we're still cool with each other, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't have to go into, like, that, like, you don't have to, like, do a scorched earth policy of, like, just absolute destruction, right? And I really, I think that there's something really neat about being on the couch with somebody. And I still play combat on – we have my wife's 1977 Atari 2600. It still works.
Wow.
We hook it up to an old CRT crappy 13-inch television.
Just to keep the vibe going.
Yeah. And we play combat and we play air sea battle and then I play Pitfall by myself. And
just so bad too. Like, the graphics are so bad.
Yeah, but when my kids were little and I still had my Sega from college, they would sort of like try to play Sega and I had like Prince of Persia, which was so great on that console stuff. And then we showed them the Atari, and when they were like, gosh, they were probably like 6 and 8 or yeah, I think 5 and 7 or 6 and 8 or something like that. And they played Atari and they loved it because it was so simple. You could put any cartridge into that game and just figure it out.
Right.
Because there just weren't a lot of choices to make, right? This is one of the reasons I think that E.T. game is such a giant failure is like not only is it not fun, but like – there's so much going on in it that you have to know all this stuff that just makes it, if you don't have the rules, you're screwed. And a lot of those old games like Dodge'em and that like fishing derby game, you know, they're so simple. And then you have to use your imagination to fill in the gaps.
It's that- almost like looking at the constellations when you see here's Orion. And I remember as a kid, I'm expecting to see like a guy in the sky, like a cartoon, but it's like three dots here and two stars there. It's like that with Atari. You have to figure out what these one lines and there's a little divot and that's supposed to be the hole. And like, what is this stuff?
You're that little blinking square with an arrow is an adventurer with a sword and you're running away from a duck, but it's a dragon and it's terrifying when you're trying to get away from it. So that was like... I think that one of the – if you talk to a lot of people who are game designers today, a couple of years after I did my keynote at PAX, Ken Levine, who designed BioShock, gave his keynote address. And then like the year either before or after, Tim Schafer went and gave his. You know, Tim did like all the LucasArts games, right? So like he – just recently I worked for Tim on Broken Age and Broken Age Part 2 and he did – Secret of Monkey Island. And so like he's really well known for a lot of that kind of work. They both cited D&D as a place that they started, right? Like they were so into those stories and so into that imagination that when they like everybody had a personal computer back then and it was like it didn't come with games. It came with the basic programming language and it was like
floppy
make
disk.
A game. Yeah. So they like they talk about that and it's like that just inspired me so much. It inspired me as a storyteller. It inspired me as a creative person. And it clearly continues to inspire me today.
Did you have a one character in D&D that was like your favorite?
I always played a wizard. So like which is weird because I like I'm a little guy, you know. When I was a little kid, I didn't even top 100 pounds until I was in probably like 8th grade, right? I was uncoordinated, I was weird, I was really shy, it was super easy to make me cry. Like I was all about reading books and stuff. So you would think I'm going to be a fighter. Right? Like, I'm going to be a badass who just walks in and is like, I don't like you, sword, stab, 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 right? but I really liked that the wizards were like, they were squishy and they were very valuable, but everybody else had to kind of protect them, and they died a lot, but if they survived, they became really strong, and they just did everything with their minds. And I kind of wanted to be that, because I was like so weak and weird and awkward on the playground that I was just like, oh God, please don't anyone talk to me or touch me, or oh man, it's dodgeball or it's kickball. Like, I was the kid when every time I went up to bat in baseball or kick in kickball, you would hear, easy out, easy out. I'm like, come on.
The worst, right?
It's awful. You know, and then I'd be like, I'm going to show them, pop up, you know, every single strike time. Out, yeah. Yeah, so I played wizards. What did you play?
I was a paladin, and my biggest guy was called Haltane.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was I lived on Wordsworth Way, and a couple streets over was Haltane Crescent. I just thought that was
That's a great name. It's a great paladin name.
And to explain to people who might not be familiar with Dungeons & Dragons is that you would build up, and correct me if I'm wrong, you would build your character up where he would get like different... You would go up the levels in the game, yeah, but also as a character.
Yeah, just like in any RPG video games or whatever. Right, yeah. So like as you gain experience through doing things, through like fighting battles and solving puzzles and getting treasure and stuff.
Right.
And then you as your reputation grows, you get more hit points.
Which is
your
life.
You get better weapons.
Yes.
And if you're a magic user, and paladins can use magic too,
yes,
you get better spells and more powerful spells.
You have more you can choose from, yeah, or whatever. So basically, this was my character for about a year.
Yeah.
And finally, he got up against a chromatic dragon,
yeah,
which is in Dungeons & Dragons lore. I think it's the top dragon.
It depends on which edition you're playing, but yeah, very close to one of the top, because they can cast all the... Not only do they have all the breath weapons, but they cast spells.
Spells as well, and yeah, just basically was destroyed and died. And,
oh,
you know, to once again, it's like, this was like your dog dying. Like,
yeah,
Haltane
sure
was dead, and I was just yeah devastated. And it was never the same for me
yeah
to play D&D after that,
yeah,
you know?
I played, I used to play on a podcast with the guys from Penny Arcade, mm-hmm, and I had an Avenger, which was a fourth edition character class. It was kind of like a rogue a little bit, sort of like a blend between like a rogue and a fighter, but he was an Eladrin, which is kind of like the cousins to the elves.
Okay.
Like, I decided that Eladrin were like, they were kind of like high elves. So the Eladrin would talk about elves like the elves are like the embarrassing hillbilly cousins that they don't want to talk about. And I really liked him. He was very serious about everything, because Avengers were sort of like, they were like cultists for their god, you know? So they were like going to convert everyone, like no matter what's like convert or die. And my character died. And he fell into an acid pit trap.
Oh.
And to this day, I think that the DM killed him on purpose. Was like, I'm going to kill someone in this adventure,
and I
just happened to be the one, because I rolled a 19 to escape from the acid pit trap, and he was like, no, that's not good enough. I'm like, really, you need a critical success to escape the acid pit trap? That's bullshit,
that, right?
And I was so upset when that character died, and I'd only been playing with him for like a year. I mean,
yeah,
it wasn't that long, you know? And there's a thing that happens, and it's one of those things I think that kind of binds us together as role players, when it's like, you never want to hear about somebody's character, right? It's like the last thing you want to know is like, I'm going to tell you all the stats about my character. It's like, oh God, please
it's
don't.
It's like showing home movies or something.
Oh man, right. Or it's like a poker player is like, let me tell you about the worst beat I ever had. I'm like, you know what? It's happened to all of us. Shut up. But there is a thing where it's like, and my character died, and you find other role players who are just like, oh man, yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I'm sure if role players who are listening to this, something has gone through their minds.
You can connect
like
that great
character that they,
you know,
lost. Yeah.
But like I said, and that's what I loved about that style of a role playing game in comparison to video games today, which are still great and still fun.
Yeah.
But it's like you said, tracing back to board games, which was a social thing. But also too, in board games, just a part of what you do. A thing I was really I don't know if intrigued or admire, but I love the fact that you have taken this initial road of being a child actor into now being such a diverse, almost like a pop culture. You know, you remind me a lot of Chris Hardwick, which is funny because I know you guys have a past we can talk about, but
yeah,
you become like this pop culture kind yeah of wizard, so to speak. You've become what you want to be.
It's, you know, I never thought of it that way,
yes,
but I guess, yeah, in some way, like, I guess bards use magic. I guess I'm a high-level bard. I started, so it was around 2000 to, like, the middle of 2000 was when I was just like, I had been trying really hard to be an actor and it just wasn't working. You know, I was like 25, 26, something like that. And I guess, no, in 2000 would have been about 28. And I was just struggling like crazy. And I had a really good body of work, but I had taken years off to go to drama school. I had been a very successful child actor, but I felt like I had gotten as far as I was going to get based on just like instinct. And I really wanted the formal training. I wanted the technique. So I went to drama school and I just stopped going on auditions during that time because I was like, man, you know, Luke Skywalker left Dagobah and he was never a full Jedi. Like he had to go complete the training. And I was like, well, I'm not going to leave. You know, I'm going to stay here and do all this. And in that time, the industry just kind of forgot about me. And I had always wanted to be a writer and I had always enjoyed writing. And I just started writing a weblog when nobody else was doing it. You know, there were less than 1,000 in the world at that time, for sure. And that kind of, I happened to do the right thing at the right time. And it was like a, you know, I was a purple cow back then. So like I could stand out, right? And that sort of started letting me reintroduce myself to the world as an adult, as myself, not as the kid from Star Trek, not as the kid from Stand By Me, right? And over time, that led to me getting more work as an actor and writing. I've written for lots of publications and magazines and newspapers and tons of websites. I'll call them in the AV Club for a really long time. And then that eventually kind of led to me working on The Big Bang Theory, which I think was kind of the tipping point of letting me go, okay, everybody remember, like I'm still here, you know? And it was like almost 5 years ago that my friend Felicia Day, who I've known since we were writers at the Acme Comedy Theater 7 years ago, she said, so I'm going to, you know, I'd already worked with her on The Guild. I loved The Guild. I loved what we did together on The Guild. And she said, so I'm thinking about starting up this channel with, you know, YouTube's doing these new channels and Hardwick's doing one and I'm doing one and I need programming for it. And she said, do you want to do a show together? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. What do you want to do? And she said, well, I know how much you like board games. So what about a show where you review board games? And I said, well, okay, so that's interesting, but talking about board games isn't that interesting, you know? And like, I don't want to do a thing where I sit in front of a green screen and review a thing. That's boring. I said, I think the best way really to like review a game is to play it. And oh my God, we could have celebrities come and play board games and it'll be like celebrity poker, but with board games. And the whole idea coalesced in a matter of minutes. And we spent the next several months developing it. And that's how my show Tabletop started. And, you know, I don't know. Tabletop definitely started to happen around a time when board games were starting to have a real renaissance in mainstream culture. It was around 1996, 97 that Settlers of Catan came to America and the Euro board game influence started to really, really go. This was right after the collectible card game market, kind of led by Magic the Gathering, had blown up and had started to fade a little bit. But there was all this interest in games again, and Dungeons & Dragons 3rd edition had come out and 4th edition was about to come out. And we don't know, we can't say for sure that if Tabletop was like leading this or just happened to be like on that tide as it was cresting. Yeah, but we came along at a really great time when board games were starting to blow up, and we've definitely been we've been part of growing the hobby, and I just wanted to show the world why it is so much freaking fun to play board games. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like when we were talking earlier about how they create relationships, they strengthen friendships, they give parents of teenagers a thing to do together when you kind of would rather not talk to each other, you know? Because like parents are like, you know, kids are like, dad, parents are lame. And parents are like, oh my God, you are such an asshole, you know? Yeah. And it's like, okay, here's a thing that we can do together that's kind of like, it's sort of neutral ground, right?
That's right.
And I've had
had the I've gotten these amazing emails from people, and I've met these people who've said my kids in the evening would just go to their corners of the house, and we would all kind of do our own things, and we started watching tabletop together, and the kids said, can we play board games after dinner? And now we do that 3-4 times a week. So
but that is such an important thing, because my little girls and my son too like to play like board games. Like you said, some of them like, let's play Monopoly. I'm like, you realize Monopoly is not like a 20-minute game.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to take us 2 hours to do. Yeah. But it does have that connection where you sit down and you have like a family time.
When I was little, my brother and sister and I would play the Mad Magazine game with my parents, which was like Monopoly in reverse. The goal was to lose all your money. So you would get places and you would like get money. And like, instead of going to jail, you would go to like Tough Luck. And there was one bill in the game that was like $632 million or something like that. And you had to get rid of it. And, you know, I haven't touched that game in forever. And I still remember those days. And before I taught my kids kind of the modern tabletop games, we played the Game of Life and Sorry and Boggle. And my wife loves word games, so I have, and I'm bad at them. I don't like them.
Scrabble and that sort of thing.
She's crazy about Scrabble, and she's really good at it too. She's one of those scores 400 points in a 2-player game Scrabble players.
Come on, right?
Yeah, and I'm like, Of is a word.
That's the Russian spelling, O-V.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, so it's been a really wonderful part of my life. Mm.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
This is Talk is Jericho.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is when you said that you were able to kind of reinvent yourself, which, as you know, being in show business as long as you have is the key to having that longevity.
Yeah.
But so many child actors never can do that.
I think that a lot of child actors aren't doing it by choice,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, and I've met a lot of those. I grew up around a lot of those kids whose parents were like making them do it, you mm-hmm. know? And, a lot of those kids were just, they were unhappy with it. You know, my parents were supportive, but I also felt like it wasn't 100% my choice. You know, mm-hmm. like I felt like I have to do this. Hmm. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I decided, yes, I want to be an actor as an adult.
Right.
And even now I kind of prefer writing,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's if something cool comes along where I can express myself artistically or something is really fun, really interesting, I'm all over that, but I'm not out like seeking out auditions every day, you know, like I was when I was mm-hmm. younger. But a lot of these kids, I would see them and they just, you know, they were unhappy. And I felt it. You know, I would go on auditions and you would see these kids whose parents were just kind of mean to them, you know, and it's kind of like, it's like they're like Little League parents, you know, or like, I saw for the first time in my life, I saw hockey parents in Canada. My kids and I were up in Lake Louise 2 winters ago, and we were playing pond hockey. And we were just goofing off. Like,
yeah.
You know, we're from Southern California. We're not, you know, we're no good. And this dad brought his two kids over and was like, do you want to play with us? And we were like, sure. Pond hockey on Lake Louise with two like just out of shape Americans. And this guy, you would have thought that we were in the playoffs for how competitive Stanley this Cup. Guy was and how much he was like yelling at the kids. And finally I was like, you know what, dude, we're good, thanks a lot, we're leaving. But the stakes are so much higher, right? Because there's a lot of money potential for child actors.
Sure.
And what I think happens to there are three broad lanes that child actors can go through. They can genuinely love the art and be raised in a well-adjusted environment where they're allowed to be children and they're allowed to screw up and grow as humans. That's really hard now. You know, like everybody makes fun of Jaden Smith for being sort of like kind of an idiot philosopher on Twitter, but I guarantee you if Twitter had existed when I was 15, it would be the most embarrassing thing in the world for me to look back on. You know, like this is a hard time to be like, a well-known person because you're not allowed to screw up. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you can't do a dumb thing. Everybody does dumb things. Everybody is drunk in public. Everybody is out of shape on the beach. Everybody is having a bad day and is rude to somebody because they just want to get where they're like, that always happens. And because there is an entire industry around like just dogpiling on that, like just you can't do it, right? So these kids who would be just like, you know, f***ing up and going on with their lives, they're not allowed to do that. That's really hard for them, okay? Which I think puts a lot of kids in this sort of second lane, which is they just get self-destructive because they're sad and they're frustrated and they burn out, right?
Right.
And then a lot of them self-medicate. And there's this mythology in the entertainment industry that you kind of have to go live like the hard party sunset strip club lifestyle for a little while and then like clean up and come back, you know? And that doesn't really work for a lot of people. And then the third lane that some people go into is they transition into a different kind of creativity. And Seth Green is a great example of that. Everything he's done with Stupid Buddy and Robot Chicken and the voice work that he does. And when Seth chooses an on-camera role now, it's really special. You know, Alyssa Milano is the same way. You know, I mean, there are a few people who just were kind of allowed to make the transition. Jodie Foster's Nerdist podcast interview from a couple months ago was really validating and helpful to me because I listened to it. Well, because she talks about being a child actor and just like going to college and learning to just sort of like be a human, right? Because when you're a kid and you're an actor, nobody treats you like you're a human being. Right. Like they or at least when I was a kid, they didn't. Right. It was like if someone tries to grab my elbow, I reflexively jerk away because I was so constantly grabbed by the elbow and pushed around.
Seriously.
By directors and stuff. You know,
no kidding.
Yeah. Because they could very easily have said, would you know, if you could walk over here so we can. And it was never they never just grab me and push me.
That's interesting.
All the time, even when I was on Star Trek. You know, and I was 14, 15, 16 years old. Directors would come in and they wouldn't call me by name. It would be the kid, the boy, the child. And like, bless the cast of Star Trek because every single one of them would say his name is Will, you know, or you don't have to grab him like that, you know, and things like that. And I think that what happens is that, and I know that I've struggled with this and I continue to struggle with this, is that just a part of me feels like, why did you take all that away from me? Like, why'd you take all that agency away from me? Why did you take all that time away from me? Instead of like, you know, like we could have done this together, right? You know, like we could have worked together.
Right.
And when parents are like, what should I do with, you know, my kids, blah, 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 and acting? And I'm like, well, first of all, don't. You know, if your kid really wants to do it, there's drama programs in school, there's local theater, there's... Any kid now can shoot, they can write and shoot and edit and release movies literally using only their phone.
Yeah.
You know, there's great ways for kids to be creatively expressive, but you get one chance in your life to be a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they can take that away from you. Mm-hmm. And that's terrible.
I think if you see that, if you take like probably like Michael Jackson, for example, with probably all the childhood taken away, which is why he was always kind of the quote unquote eternal child.
Yeah.
You know, you miss out on so much of these things because you're being treated like an adult, but not, you're kind of in the middle.
Yeah. You know? God, you know, I just remembered, I don't know why this, probably because I'm talking to you, but this just super clear memory flashed into my head. So it was probably, let's see, my sister was probably 5, so it was probably like 82, 83, something like that. I was so into WWF.
Oh, yeah.
Oh boy. I mean, I was crazy into it, right?
Yeah.
Like every Saturday morning, right? And that year that the record came out.
Yeah, it was
and
probably like 84,
something like that. Yeah, right? And then we had like the toys, right? And those toys were great. And we had the wrestling ring and all that.
Yeah.
And wrestling was coming to the sports arena in LA. And my dad, we asked our parents if we could go, and my dad bought the family tickets to go. And I didn't do a lot. The reason I'm thinking of this is I didn't do a lot of, like, these are things kids do with their family stuff, because I was always at work and we were going to premieres and, like, right. This was just a thing that was for fun, that was for the family. So we go to the sports arena and we did not have a lot of money in those days. And we went in and I expected that we would be, you know, way up in the cheap seats. And we walk in, and this, there we go in, and we go into the mezzanine, you know, like the concourse. And instead of going up, we go down. And we keep going down, and we keep going down, and we get on the floor. And my dad, I don't know how he did it, had gotten us tickets that were like six or seven rows back from this, from the edge of the wrestling ring. And I can remember clearly. So I remember Jimmy Superfly Snuka was there that night, and he, so we were like kind of off the corner, right? And he, like, he did his Superfly jump thing, yeah, like right in front of me. And that night it was a steel cage match between Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. And is like, I bet I could find, if I'm sure there's a database somewhere that's like, these are the people that were on the card. Oh, and the location. Sure, I could probably go find that. Yeah. But it was this like magical moment for me. And it is one of, like, you know, there's like 10 of those in my entire life. And it's so funny. I haven't thought about that in years. But every time I see you, I get wrestling on the brain.
Yeah, that's
so I was
right.
Like,
yeah,
oh, yeah. But that is one of those. That's one of those times where, like, my parents were like, let's go do a thing that families do and kids do, you know?
And, but, you know, and here's something that kind of fits in with that is that, I guess it was last summer, my son and his friend from down the street were hanging out, and my wife was somewhere else. And so I said, you guys want to watch a movie? And they said, sure. I said, well, let me show you this movie that I used to like when I was a kid, Stand By Me. We watched it.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And to watch it with them, they were probably 10 at the time.
Yeah.
A, just a brilliant piece of filmmaking, but B, forget how, like, lots of swearing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great, such a great movie.
That's
though.
A perfect age to watch
it
that.
It really
movie.
Is, you know, with, you know, the guy who's puking all over the place, yeah, and the leech on the balls and all that stuff. It's just such a great movie. Is do you ever look back on it and go like, it's part of American cinema history, yeah, and you were in it.
This August 8th this year will be the 30th anniversary, yeah, of that movie being released. And wow, the only reason I know that is because August 8th is my wife's birthday, and she went to see it on her birthday.
No kidding.
It was her 16th birthday. Mm-hmm. She's 3 years older than me. So we had filmed it the year before, and I didn't know until less than 1 year ago that the film was nearly shut down the day before production began, because whoever was financing it pulled the financing.
Really?
And Rob Reiner got on the phone to, I think, Norman Lear, who he had worked with, you know, all the family
yeah,
and had a long relationship, and said, I need, you know, whatever, $1 million or something. And he was like, okay, here you go. We had already we were in Oregon. We were on location. We were like, we had been there for 2 weeks prepping for the movie. And when we filmed it, you know, none of us knew that we were making something that was going to become this kind of like American classic, right? Like, last night I was watching Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould and Sterling Hayden, and just, there's a couple of movies where I watch them and I enjoy them as a movie, but I'm so blown away by the filmmaking that I lose the plot. Guardians of the Galaxy does that to me. I have yet to watch Guardians of the Galaxy all the way through and actually follow the story because I'm so blown away by the filmmaking and the photography and the special effects and all that stuff.
Right.
So I was watching, same thing with Long Goodbye, I was watching that. And to think that Stand By Me is one of those things that can legitimately be mentioned in the same breath as Long Goodbye or Love Story.
Absolutely.
Or you know, or Taxi Driver or Godfather or something like that, blows my freaking mind. None of us knew that anything like that was going to happen when we were working on the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like we were doing something special. I felt like we were doing something cool, but I didn't know that it was what it was going to be. And then it was like a year. So by the time it came out the following summer, I'd kind of like forgotten about it, you know. I'd gone to do other things, and then it came out. And when it came out, we were on vacation, and like the whole family. My parents had a motorhome, and we did one of those national park vacation things. And when I came home, there was there were boxes of fan mail that had been sent to the studio on the front porch, and I stayed up all night reading it and trying to answer it, because I thought that's what I had to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how much that was going to change my life. Mm. And it took a while for it to kind of sink in and then kind of get used to that new reality. And it's an amazing, wonderful part of my life. A lot of people spend their entire acting careers never getting something like Stand By Me in their, you know, in their body of work. And I got mine like when I was a kid. So everything I do stands on the shoulders of that, you know, which is great. But at the same time, it's sort of like, geez, was that a fluke? Do I objectively suck? And I just got lucky when that happened.
It's like you won a Stanley Cup in your first season.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, no, absolutely. Right. It's exactly like that. You know, like part of me just really wants to continue to dislike Sidney Crosby. But the reality is, like, that kid has grown and matured and is, I still don't think that he should have gotten MVP. I think I really think MVP should have gone to Murray or to Jones. But
Crosby's the marquee guy, though.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and that was just, and it's just like, ugh, God damn it, Bettman, you know. or to Kessel, who was a beast this year. Yeah. Oh my god,
unbelievable.
How's that the same guy who was in Toronto two seasons ago? That's
the blossom of a player.
Exactly.
You know, the blossom of an actor. You know,
yeah,
same thing.
Yeah.
Right?
So you get into a place where you can do your work, right? But I still struggle with that. You know, it's just like, you got to do it again, right? So it's like, I'm sure for somebody like Crosby, like you get another one now at almost 30 and you're like, okay, it's real.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Same thing with, like, I remember when Doughty came to play for the Kings at 18, you know, and he's like, and he's on his way to being like one of the great defensemen, I think probably in, you know, certainly in this century and probably in the last 30 years or something like that, you know, and to win a Stanley Cup and that, you know, like 3 years after he comes into the league, but then to do it the second time. I feel like the first time you do it is you sort of like, I don't know, there's just that thing about like, all right, well, I planted the flag there. Can I get back and do it again? I just think that there's...
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I know the first time I won the world championship in the WWE was 2000 and let's say one.
Yeah.
Didn't win it again until 2008. And then the kind of the waistline in between, you're wondering, like, was it a fluke? I mean, obviously wrestling show business, but even from
winning an Oscar
or getting a part, can
absolutely.
I do this again?
Yeah. Because there's only so much you can do.
That's right.
Right? There's all these other decisions are being
yes.
made. And like, while you are like this known commodity and like, you know, you've got like, you bring this particular thing to, you know, to the ring. And I remember watching you back then and I remember everything, you know, but then at the same time here comes whoever, you know, here comes a different person and it's like, well and then from a business standpoint they're like, well, that guy costs less, so let's invest more in that guy,
right.
You know, and
he's younger,
right, and then you're like, and it's, that's the thing of being a performer, right, and like you guys have that weird thing where you're phenomenal athletes but you're also performers, you know? And it's like, I remember I was a huge Mick Foley fan. I loved him as a personality, but I loved his book. And I enjoyed watching him, you know, as I cannot think of any other sport in the world where you could get as profoundly injured as he did. And you are expected to keep going, right?
Right.
Because everybody in the crowd is like, oh my God, he just fell 30 feet to the ground and landed on his back. Let's keep going, you know? I mean, that's just...
That's true.
That is mind-blowing to me, you know? And then you see, like, I love soccer, right? So I'm watching the Champions Cup right now, and I'm watching the Copa America, and I'm seeing these guys who are like, that guy looked at me.
Taking the big dives.
This is the biggest dive ever. And I'm like, you are such a pussy. Like, you wouldn't last for a second in rugby. You wouldn't last in roller derby. Like, come on. You're making millions of dollars. Like, such a baby. But there are all those, like, for anyone that's a performer, it's just like, you do the best you can do. And it took me a long time to kind of like get okay with the reality that like you can do the best you can do and still not get the thing, because here's 100 decisions that you don't even know about that you had nothing to do with that you never could have affected that that got made.
Right.
I have heard of executives at studios, like, they want to cancel show A, but they can't because of a deal or whatever like that, right? So they cancel show B that's doing great, that shouldn't be canceled, just to show show A that they can do it.
Wow.
It happens all the time. And now 400 people are out of work.
Right.
And it's just gone because someone's ego was like, well, I have to show everybody, you know, that I'm the boss,
yeah,
or
the
whatever like that.
Did you have, we were talking about like something like Stand By Me, which is once in a lifetime in a lot of ways, with those four other dudes, the four of you guys.
Yeah.
Is there like, I mean, obviously, no, Rivers passed away, but is there some kind of a bond there that you'll never forget? Or is it just
You know, there really is. And if you'd asked me this 2 years ago, I would have said, nah, not really. But we all got together.
Really?
Yeah, we all got together. Corey and Jerry and Rob and Dreyfus and I, we all got together. I can't remember why we had been brought together, but we were brought together to talk about the movie. And it was the first time.
Like on a panel or something?
Yeah, it was for like, you know, it was for like the Today Show, or Good Morning America or something like that. And we walked in, and it was the first time we had all been in the same place in a really long time. River and I were really close.
Really?
We were super, super, super close during production. I was the weird kid that everybody picked on. And, you know, like, because it was so easy to make me cry, you know, and you get four boys together and that's just sort of like, you know, it's
pack mentality.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there was this sort of like, they were like, you know, everybody just sort of like teased me a lot because that was an easy thing to do. But River was always really kind to me. And we were really, really close right up until I was probably about 16. He was a couple years older than me. And he just kind of was pulled in. He was much more successful than I was as an actor. And he was on location a lot. And I was working on Star Trek, which was a different kind of success and a different kind of thing. And I felt like he was the real actor, you know. And I really looked up to him. And it was around that time that he was really self-medicating himself with drugs. And he had taken on the responsibility of supporting his entire family. And he was a legitimately talented actor. I mean, he would have... I remember when he was nominated for an Academy Award, and you could see the relief on his face when he didn't win. Because he didn't want it, you know? Like, you could see that he wanted to do the work, but you could see how much he was hurting. And I didn't know what to do, right? Because, like, it just made me really uncomfortable. I never went to parties. I never went to clubs. I was never even experimented with drugs when I was a teenager. It was like I was never interested in it. And as a consequence, he and I just sort of drifted apart. And it was sad, but it was like, okay, you know, well, we'll come back together someday. And then he's dead. Mm-hmm. And I carried around this, like, sadness of, like, I wonder if we could have been friends. You know, what would happen if we were adults? Would our kids play together? Would we have gone to weddings together? That sort of thing. But the reality was we had drifted apart. And Corey was always tough to be around. I don't dislike him at all. Mm-hmm. I'm fond of him. But he's very much a product of his environment. And his parents were awful and used him and exploited him and just like wrung as much money out of him as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. And it was really clear that he never learned how to say, like, he never learned how to establish boundaries with people, never learned to, like, you know, say to people in Hollywood, no, you can't exploit me that way, and kind of didn't know how to not be famous, mm-hmm. right? And that made me really uncomfortable, you know? And then he and Corey Haim were, like, they were part of, like, the heroin scene, and I was like, well, that's not my deal, so we stayed apart. Jerry lived in New York. And Jerry and I corresponded before email. We would send letters to each other, you know, and it was too expensive to phone call. So we would just send letters. And we stayed in touch for a really, really long time and then just sort of slowly drifted apart. And then I got to this point in my life where I was like, I am a giant failure. I was in Stand By Me. It's one of the biggest movies ever. I was in Star Trek, one of the biggest things in the world. I quit Star Trek to go have a film career. Didn't have that film career because I chose to go to school instead. Came back from school, and now no one wants to hire me. I am a giant loser. Like, I've made a series of terrible, terrible, terrible decisions. I was ashamed of everything. And I felt like, well, I certainly can't call these guys up. I can't be around these guys. I can't talk to any of these people. I need to, like, you know, they're famous and successful, and I'm a has-been, and I'm 25, you know, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So I just kind of retreated and kind of withdrew into my own thing. And around this time also, I have depression and anxiety, and I see a psychiatrist and a therapist, and I take antidepressants, and I have a great life as a result of all that stuff. But at that time, I wasn't getting help. So I had untreated depression, which is the worst, right? Because you wake up in the morning and your brain's like, hey, guess what? You and you're like, wait, what? I don't, you know,
yeah, what did I do?
you know, and your brain's just like, no, you're going to feel terrible about everything all day today because reasons, right? So they got us all together, this whatever it was show brought us all together, and we walked in, and like I got there first because it was in Toluca Lake, which is real close to where I live. So I walked in to the theater, and I was just kind of like standing around waiting, you know. I saw Rob and I said hello to him. I saw Dreyfuss and said hello to him, and Jerry came in. And I walked up to Jerry, and, you know, when we worked together, Jerry was a little fat kid. And now he's like the big, beautiful, you know,
Greek
guy,
god,
right?
Yeah.
You know, and I'm looking at him, and he's walking, and he's looking at him, and he's, and I'm looking at him as he walks close to me. And I've done a lot of comedy the last few years, right? I've done a little bit of stand-up. I used to write sketch comedy for a lot. So, like, that's one of the places my brain goes. That's like my, my safe place,
yeah,
you know? It's
mechanism.
Like, you know, my brain is just like, let's make jokes about shit. So he's walking up to me, and I'm like, at least once in his life, he has said, no, Rebecca Romijn, I do not want to fuck you. I'm tired. Like, right? So I start to laugh. And he comes over and he's like, what are you laughing about? And I'm like, you don't want to know, but it's so good to see you. And it was like no time had passed.
Right.
Zero time had passed. And then Corey came in and I was like, oh, my God. Look at you. And he hugged me and he was like, it's so good to see you. And it was like no time had passed. And then we all got together. We sat on this stage together. And this is the first time we've been together in over 20 years, all of us. And Rob says, we're like sitting there waiting. There's just 2 seconds of silence. And Rob says, I feel like there should be an empty chair here for River.
Oh, wow.
And we all just were just like, every one of us starts to tear up. Because it made very real that he wasn't there, and he was, and he'll never be there, you know. And there's this line in Stand By Me where the adult Gordy says something like, "I hadn't thought about him in years, but I know I'll miss him forever." And that's how I felt in that moment, and it was really overwhelming and really sad, and kind of informed the whole discussion that we ended up having, and we've all stayed in touch to a certain degree since then. You know, every now and then somebody sends, I follow some of the, there's some really neat Stand By Me tumblers. So a new generation of kids is discovering Stand By Me. Young kids are discovering Stand By Me. And there are kids that cosplay Stand By Me at conventions and stuff.
Because you can relate to it as a kid, no matter what generation or what year it is, you know?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's what Rob tells the story about how right after the movie came out, he was, he was somewhere and some guy was like, you know, so I saw Stand By Me and boy, did it remind me of my friends and me when we were kids. And Rob said, oh, did you grow up in a rural area? And he's like, no, I grew up in Queens. But we did those kinds of adventures. And Rob said that's when he realized this movie is about, like, this movie transcends certain things, right? When my boys were probably around 10, 8 and 10 or maybe 10 and 12, I let them watch it. They'd been asking about it and I let them watch it and I watched it with them. And to them as kids, it's weird seeing their dad as a kid, you know, but also like it's an adventure story for kids, right? It's a really fun adventure story for kids.
You're right.
For adults, it's a very different movie. For adults, especially as a father,
great call,
to watch
man.
That movie, you know, it is. It's about that moment in your life where you're not a kid anymore. And it's great, but it's also a tragedy because you don't realize what you've lost, you know? And it is about how, you know, you can see those kids are archetypes. The characters are archetypes. So you think about that kid that was never given a chance to break out, you know? That kid who was, like, set up to just be the bad kid. So he was like, all right, I'm going to be the bad kid, you know? And it's this totally different movie. And I think that's one of many reasons that it endures.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's all on the writing and the filmmaking and the casting and like really a pizza trophy to Rob Reiner for casting four boys who were basically those characters.
Well, just, yeah, your descriptions of them in real life is the characters of the guys, and, mm-hmm. you know, even to the point of you and River being close, just like Gordy and I can't remember what his
Chris.
Name. Chris. Chris.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And so weird the way that we drifted apart.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
like the movie, right?
Yeah, it's weird. I've toyed with the idea, because I think this would be fun, I've toyed with the idea of recording the adult narration for Stand By Me. The adult Gordy, and then just releasing it like on SoundCloud so like somebody could sync it up and watch it if they wanted to. And then like reshooting the end with like my kids and my camera.
Yeah.
I think that would be disrespectful to Richard if I did that.
Yeah,
but it is a thing that has crossed my mind because I'm like, oh, that would be really cool.
Yeah,
just because I'm a writer as an adult.
Sure,
now,
sure. You're talking about endearing, and this is funny because there's types of fans, and I've found in my life that wrestling fans,
yeah.
Kiss fans,
yeah.
And Star Wars / Star Trek fans are the most loyal / lunatic / craziest groups of fans that you can have.
Yeah, you know, I wonder, like, I'm not a giant Kiss fan.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, some of it that I like, but I'm not crazy about it, you know? But good God, like, the most passionate fans.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's, like, Kiss fans. Deadheads are like that. The Violent Femmes, for some reason, have this weird alt rock deadhead following kind of thing that goes on, you know? You know, I don't really know what that is, but yeah, absolutely. I have as much fun watching wrestling now as an almost, you know, as a mid 40s dude,
yeah,
as I did when I was 12, 13, 14 years old, you know? And I love watching those. Like, I watch the classics, you know, those old, where it was like at the Spectrum in 1977 or whatever, you know?
And MSG.
Like, yeah, right? And like Vince McMahon's like 11 years old or whatever, you know? or like Gorilla Monsoon and Mean Gene Okerlund, you know?
Right.
And I'm just like, it is as fun and as like, it lands on us in a way. And Star Wars and Star Trek do the same thing. And I wonder if it has something to do with just being... I just dumped water all over my table. I wonder if it has something to do with being like... There's something mythological about it.
Yes.
Right? You know, there's definitely... I love that about wrestling, you know? Like, before I knew what a heel and a face was, you know, I was just like, I knew who the good guys were and I knew who the bad guys were.
Like a movie, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's just sort of like, it's almost like a four-color comic book, right? It's just like, the good guys were white and the bad guys were black and, like, things are big and bigger than life. And Star Wars and Star Trek are the exact same way. I mean, and even, you know, and there are great morality plays in all of that, right? There's great morality plays in wrestling. There's mm-hmm. great morality plays in Star Wars and Star Trek. And then you've got people, that's really interesting, right? You have people who are like, Star Wars forever, I hate Star Trek, you know?
And Beatles and Stones. Like I said, that's the division.
Absolutely. And it's rare. The reasons that people kind of like and dislike are very interesting. Eric Kaplan, one of the writers on Big Bang Theory, who was also a writer on Futurama, one of the smartest people I know, he says, I don't care for Star Wars because Star Wars is fantasy and Star Trek is science fiction. And I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, Star Wars has the Force and the Force is magic. Star Trek has science. And I was like, but the transporter. And he goes, right, but it's grounded in science.
True.
And you're right. It's definitely Beatles and Stones.
That could be your reason why you like one other than the other, right?
Yeah.
Have you gone to any Star Trek conventions or do you ever do that scene at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not doing any this year. Mm-hmm. I'm taking this year off because I have a lot of writing that I want to do. And I just need some time home. I need to not be on the road.
Sure.
Right? I was on the road a lot last year.
But when you go, what kind of reception do you get?
Really positive and wonderful. When I was a kid, I would go to comic book conventions and I would go to horror conventions and sci-fi conventions. When it was like 300 people at the now torn down Ambassador Hotel in LA.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
And I loved it. It was great. It was so much fun to be around people who liked the same thing I did, but also liked it the same way I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
In the early 80s, there wasn't a lot of that. In the early 80s, you know, science fiction wasn't cool. And Star Wars and Alien and Blade Runner were kind of like, they were big, you know, Close Encounters. They were like big blockbuster movies. But that sense of community that fandom gives us now, I don't remember it really existing when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall feeling like if I'm going someplace in a Doctor Who shirt, someone else who watches Doctor Who is going to be like, yeah, Doctor Who, right? It's more like that someone's going to come up to me and go, nerd, and like punch me, you know?
It was like that for music, though. Like if you, like, for example, when Metallica first came out,
yeah.
If you were walking down the street, actually one of my friends that I'm still friends with to this day, we walked past each other in the middle of the night in a football field walking home. Is it Metallica? Yeah. You like Metallica? Yeah. Because I had a Metallica shirt on.
Yeah.
But as far as like Doctor Who or science fiction, it wasn't like it is now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That was so, yeah. That's so like you can, there's that cool thing about kind of like, you're like announcing your, it's like you're carrying a flag.
Yeah, sure.
You know what I mean? Like
your colors.
This is your banner, yeah. Right? And it's like, who else, you know, who else is sworn to this banner, right? And it's great. I love that. But it wasn't like that back then. And I grew to really love conventions because they were a place where I could find people where I was just, it was okay to be not cool.
Right.
Right. Then after starting work on Star Trek, I was kind of like on the other side of the autograph table. And because I remember what it's like to be a kid who waits in line for a half an hour to meet somebody, I work really, really hard when I'm at those conventions to like really give people a good, memorable experience. You know, I don't want them to feel bummed. I don't want them to feel taken right. advantage of or taken for granted or anything like that. I do not always succeed, but it's an effort that I really like very strongly make every single time. And I have a really good time and people are really nice to me. And I've probably met 500,000 people over the years, you know, all over the world. And everybody's got a lot of stories kind of overlap about what that means to them. But everybody's got this unique take on why it's a thing that matters to them. And that's one of the things that I wasn't really prepared for when I started working on Star Trek. I was already a fan of Star Trek. And I enjoyed science fiction and I was like into all that stuff. But I never realized this is a thing that makes people want to be engineers. This is a thing that makes people want to do things that are bigger than themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the coolest things in my adult life is meeting people who are like in their 20s now, and they are scientists and engineers because they thought Wesley Crusher, my character, was really cool, and they wanted to do that stuff when they grew up.
That's cool.
Because when I was a little kid, I would meet people, and I'd talk to people, and they went into science and engineering and those fields because they thought Scotty was cool. So to be in that, like, it's like being in a pantheon, you know? To like
right.
be part of that is, it's a tremendous gift. And I work real hard not to take any of that for granted.
Mm-hmm. Like you said, you're very fortunate as a performer to have those roles that people hold very dear.
Yeah. I think if you talk to any artist, any creator, you know, we want to do a thing that matters. You know, mm-hmm. we want our work to land on people in a way that like just that does something a little more than provide a delightful diversion for 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like just something like being a dad really changed me, and being a dad, and I saw how important it is because I see how parents are not like actively involved in raising their kids. And I see how like raising kids, like here, watch TV, you know, or
yeah.
like, you know, go whatever, you know? So I work really hard to like, on Tumblr, I'm like the internet's dad, you know? I want to make art that challenges the way people think about things and inspires people to do things. And it's something that you know, you don't just delete it off the server and forget about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just as a couple things, do you enjoy doing the sitcom format with Big Bang?
Oh, it's the best.
I mean, you're so great on it. My wife's a huge fan. And she's like, you got to ask about Big Bang Theory.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, it's wonderful. It is, it's so much fun. The four camera show is a much easier schedule than a single camera show.
Mm.
We shoot at Warner Brothers, which is a real easy drive for me, which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to live in LA, you got to live where you work.
Right.
or life sucks, right?
Yes, it'll kill you.
And that cast is magnificent. Half the cast, all have advanced degrees
in, for real,
in theater and the arts. And Mayim's a PhD.
She really is
and,
smart.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah. And then the other half of the cast, they've been working in sitcoms for so long that they're basically lifers and they really know what they're doing. And it's a set where everybody respects the work. Hmm. Everybody knows how lucky they are to have the job. Everybody knows how lucky they are to be on the top rated series in the English speaking world. Right. And they're just all great people. Right. Everybody gets along. It's a family. There are occasional family squabbles, not a big deal. But when I go there, they make me feel like I have been there since the very first day. And I've been doing shows since the second or third season. Mm-hmm. And they have treated me like I was part of their family from day one.
Yes,
and it's wonderful. I love it. It's so much fun. I want that show to go on forever because not only am I a fan of it, but because I just love working on it.
Well, you fit perfectly too because they're all Star Trek fanatics.
It's really
you
fun.
Come, you know.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being the nemesis to Sheldon's character. That was really a lot of fun. But I'm also really glad that they rewrote the character and they let the Sheldon Will Wheaton relationship evolve and change so that they become friends.
Yeah,
because it lets us do more things mm-hmm. together. There's like I feel like the Will Wheaton on the Big Bang Theory is more of a troll than I am in real life, you know, and really enjoys just kind of like setting Sheldon up to do ridiculous things and like enjoys it, you know, like he just sort of enjoys creating trouble and then like letting it play out. You know, I'm not like that.
But that's a fun thing to do. Like I do it too. I play Chris Jericho in the WWE, but I'm also yeah. Chris Jericho, you know, in real life as you are Will. Sometimes yeah. people get confused between the different, I'm sure Seinfeld went through it too when he did Seinfeld. That's Seinfeld.
You know, it took me 5 years of working on the Big Bang Theory to separate in my head intellectually and emotionally Will Wheaton, the character, from Will Wheaton, the person. You know?
Yeah.
What is that like for you as a wrestler? Do you have to maintain Chris Jericho, the persona, when you're like out in the world?
No, because, you know, now it's show business, right?
Yeah.
But wrestling is a very strange animal because it's got one foot in reality and one foot in fantasy.
Yeah.
And the lines are very blurry.
Yeah.
So there was times when I was like the most evil bad guy where people were attacking me on the street, not even during the show, like yeah. literally attacking me because I was the bad guy, not yeah. realizing that, you know, Anthony Hopkins isn't really Hannibal Lecter
yeah,
walking
yeah.
down the street yeah. in a straitjacket eating a liver with a fine Chianti.
Yeah.
So there's it's a strange world because of the blurred lines of reality yeah. and fantasy.
I remember when Kurt Angle was like just the trolliest trolly heel in the yeah, world, yeah. and I loved him.
Right.
I was so into that, and I always thought, if I ever met him, I would hope that I could be like, I love everything you do, and he'd be like, cool, instead of like staying in character.
Right.
I did an episode of The Weakest Link a million years ago, and I met the woman who's the host of The Weakest Link, and I was really afraid of her.
Sure.
You know? And she was, we were backstage, and I don't recall exactly what she said to me, but she was really nice. And I was like, and I said, this is really fun, mm-hmm. you know, and I really appreciate that you are giving me as good as I'm, you know, as you're getting from me. And she smiled and she winked at me and she said, no, I'm meant to be very mean to you. So no one can see me being friendly. I have to go now. And I just thought, you know, that is so weird, you know, because like, those lines between reality and fantasy have been blurred so much that it's almost like, you know, I have friends on soap operas and these people who are just, they're like disconnected from reality. You're like, how could you do that to blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah,
yeah.
blah. Like, I'm
just playing a part.
None of this is real.
Yeah, it's not real. I know. I'll get that sometimes though. People come, like recently I'm a bad guy now on the show and people yeah. come to you go, Jericho, you're such a great heel. You're such a great heel. Can I have an autograph? And I go, no, get the hell out of here. Because if you're saying I'm a great heel, then okay.
But that's great.
I'm
that's
great.
So
get the hell out of here.
But that is so much better.
Right.
Like I would be like, oh man, he was like, yeah, go f*** yourself. And I was like, yeah, I totally should. that's cool. And there is something really great about having that level of awareness mm-hmm. and relationship with the fans of things where you can we're all having fun.
That's right.
You know what I mean? And it's great. Like, yeah. I like that a lot. I think that that is, you know, like, I remember a million years ago, I was in Texas somewhere, and Bill Laimbeer was in the hotel that I was in.
Bill
Laimbeer, who was one of the Detroit
yeah,
Pistons.
Yeah, yeah, sure, right.
And this was when they were the bad guys of basketball, yeah. Right? And the Lakers, this was still Showtime Lakers, and the Lakers just dominated the league. And I don't remember what he said to me, but I said something to him about how the Lakers are constantly defeating them in championships. And I thought he was going to tear my head off my body. And he's a big freaking dude, you know? And I'm like, oh, we're not having fun. Like, he's taking this really super seriously. It's time for me to leave, you know? And like, I don't know. I like being able to have fun with it.
Yeah, sure.
Cause it's just,
that's what it's all
like. It's just, it's all so ridiculous. And we're all really lucky to do what we do.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly.
And we're really lucky to get to entertain people and inspire people.
That's exactly right.
And CM Punk and I are friendly because he's all about the Blackhawks. And,
oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And you know, and we both, like, we're just two guys who love hockey on Twitter together, you know?
Yeah.
And I've had some really wonderful times just talking with him and like, just like, you know, BSing with him and stuff. And then the terrible things people say to him on Twitter, like, they'll jump into this thing that we're doing, and I'm like, but Phil's a really nice guy. What in the world is wrong with you?
Wrestling fans, like I said, that's like, what they do.
Why would you say those things to him? He's such a nice guy. Yeah, and then I'm just like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Last question. Of all the celebrities you've had on Tabletop, who is the worst sport?
God, really? You know what's funny is my friend Claire Grant is married to Seth Green.
Yeah.
And Claire is the sweetest, nicest. I love them. They're like family to us. And we're super close friends. And we double date all the time. And I just adore her. And she is so f***ing competitive when we play board games that, like, she can't have fun. Like, she's like, something changes in my brain. Just something snaps. Something goes off. And I can't just relax. And Seth's like, oh, my God, it's the worst. So this season, I don't recall what game we played, but we played a game that was a co-op game. And it was either we all win or we all lose. And we were like, maybe Claire will finally relax and have fun in this game. No. No. Super, super, super competitive and super hardcore. And it's funny. We cut it into the thing. You know, we make fun out
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, sure.
Right? But one of the things that doesn't really happen on Tabletop, because when I invite people to come and play, I tell them, you know, this is one of the things that I want to share with the world. And one of the things that I taught my children is that we should never sacrifice the joy of the experience in pursuit of victory.
Right.
It's that thing about, like, you know, don't give up the journey because you're so focused on the destination. When my kids were little and they were in, like, Little League and stuff, their bio dad was, like, super competitive. And it was very much like, if you don't win, you're a loser, you know? And I thought that that just sucked. And I would try real hard to, like, mitigate that with my kids. And I would tell them, like, look, man, if you're only having fun when you win, you're not getting everything you can get out of this experience. And you just cannot win all the time.
Yeah.
It's just not possible, you know? Mm-hmm, like, even these prize fighters who go out and they, you know, they retire 11-0, they lost a lot when they were on their way to, like, defending their belts and stuff, you know? Like,
right, sure.
It just, life is, you're gonna lose sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's not a big deal if you just find ways to have fun while you're doing it. So in Tabletop, it's mostly about all of us goofing off and having fun together. And the experience of playing the game. So other than Claire, nobody has ever really come on and just taken it really seriously and, like, gotten pissed, you know?
Well, next season I'll come on and I'll flip the table. We'll do a big word, but we won't tell anybody.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, yeah.
We'll do it for sure.
Yeah, you have an open invitation anytime.
Right, thank you, man.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming to my house.
Oh, it's great. What's your favorite board game in here?
Right now, it's Pandemic Legacy, which is really fun. It's the board game Pandemic, but it has a story that okay. changes as you play it, and you actually change the board. You put stickers on the board, you tear up cards, and all that stuff. But there's just about any game in here I will play.
You got Candyland in here somewhere?
I don't have Candyland, but I do have Star Trek Monopoly.
There you go.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Will Wheaton's Tabletop Show on YouTube is tremendous, hilarious, very entertaining. Seth Green, Talk is Jericho alumni, Paul Scheer, Jason Ritter, Jamie King are some of the celebs who've played board games with Will. He is a master. And, of course, you can see him on The Big Bang Theory, one of my wife's favorite shows. And, of course, Stand By Me, Gordy Lachance, one of the best movies of all time. Will's a great guy. Thank you so much to Will. So thanks to you guys for listening. Well, I'm rolling out the thank yous. Big thank you to all of you, of course, for supporting Talk is Jericho. And all the great sponsors who make it possible. DDP Yoga. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho now to get 30% off the DDP Yoga Now app and all DDP Yoga related merch. Little Caesars, get the Smokehouse Pizza for just $9 plus tax for limited time. Don't forget about True Car. Get the car for the cheapest price, quick and easy. Go to the True Car app and do that. And the Jericho Network has another smash hit on his hands, The Raven Effect. You guys are loving Raven's podcast. He's talking about anything and everything that can come into his head. It's basically a 45-minute, one long run-on sentence. He's tremendous. His delivery is hilarious. It's one of my favorite new shows that I've heard in a long time. In the last episode that came out on Monday, he hit on SpongeBob SquarePants, Mike and Dave Need Wedding Date Movie, Tooth Fairy Payouts. He talks wrestling once in a while as well. He talks about whatever the hell comes into his brain, and he's so smart and so crazy. You're going to love it. It's hilarious. Hit subscribe on iTunes if you haven't already. Leave him a rating and review, and do it for Talk is Jericho as well. I want to get up to 2,000 comments. I want 2,000 comments. That's the goal. I know you can help me get there. It'll be a huge help on this show with advertisers and getting more great guests. So hit the comments section on iTunes. Let me know what you're digging and what you want to hear on this show. If we get to 2,000 comments, I will have a special guest for all of you. Okay? 2,000 comments and see what happens. I got a big treat in store for you guys. And don't forget, Beyond the Darkness, bringing the creepy, freaky tales of the paranormal to you 5 days a week. Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis just killing it on that show. All these great topics. I don't even know where they get all these guests from. A lot of freaky people out there. And of course, Team Tiger Awesome enjoying a resurgence, dropping new laughs every Sunday. This last Sunday, they did the showdown of Saturday morning cartoon gangs, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles versus the Smurfs, the Pro Stars versus Mr. T and his magic gymnastic team. You got to hear it. It's pretty funny. But of course, Team Tiger Awesome, also known for their great ads. And you want fake news? They got fake news. Hilarious fake news like this.
This is the news with Team Tiger Awesome. In sports this week, after years of taking it one game at a time, staying within themselves, and thanking God just for the opportunity to be there, the Cleveland Browns have decided that none of that actually works. So in an effort to shake things up, they'll be thanking someone else just for the opportunity to be there. Open tryouts to fill the spot formerly held by God will be in early April. So best of luck to everybody involved. The most surprising Oscar of 2017 would be awarded not to Moonlight, but at the Science and Tech Awards to the creators of an animatronic horse head. The robot horse head is said to possess incredibly lifelike eye movements and chewing and be almost indistinguishable from a real horse on camera, as well as cheaper and easier to work with. Meaning the horse head and the bed from The Godfather now has something in common with coal miners. A hatred of immigrants. This has been the news with Team Tiger Awesome. For more, listen to the Team Tiger Awesome Show every Sunday right here on the Jericho Network.
I know you want more of that Team Tiger Awesome every Sunday. And, of course, Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus, bringing the smartest, most intelligent wrestling talk to the network. And, of course, the flagship show, Keep It 100 with Conan, Hilarity, Ridiculosity with Conan, Disco Inferno, KG, Juventud Guerrera, Shane Helms. The whole gang is there, and it's a blast every week. So I'm keeping it entertained. I got a lot more shows coming up, some wrestling, some not. Trust me, if I have them on my network, I think you are going to love it. And don't forget Friday, okay? What can I say? It's the biggest podcast ever. Mick Foley makes his Talk as Jericho debut. What are we going to talk about? Who knows, man? It's going to be worth it. I'm telling you, I've been waiting for a whole year. Friday, we'll be here very, very soon. Can't wait for you to hear that, and can't wait for you to hear the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday, here's a good one.
mind freak. Chris Angel is going to be here, one of the greatest magicians of our time, one of the greatest illusionists of our time. I went to his Las Vegas theater and his dressing room, and we had an amazing conversation. Chris is a very intense and kind of a creepy guy in a good way. You're going to love it. The mind freak, Chris Angel, is going to be here. So we'll see you on Wednesday. Have a great weekend. Don't forget Downtown Bruno. What a conversation we had with him. Talking Shop live in Mexico City. Absolute ridiculosity. Suicide Silence was here. All the great shows on the Jericho Network. And, of course, all the great episodes on Talk is Jericho. If you're bored this weekend, go back and check some of them out. They're all fun. Sebastian Bach, what a lunatic he is. And don't miss out on legendary Canadian wrestling promoter Tony Candelo. He's amazing as well. So go have a listen. Have a good time. Stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs. And a big yeah, boy, to you and yours.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.